At the outset this morning, I want to reiterate something that is always true for me, but that I haven't reinforced for a while. And I was reminded of this after our gathering last week, when someone in the community asked me what I was reading these days. And honestly, I think it's entirely possible that I have never had an original thought in my life. And I don't mean I never combine things in a way that feels germane to me. I know I do that. So this is not, I'm not being disingenuous when I say that, at least not in my own mind. It's just that there are so many brilliant people in the world who do such a remarkable job of thinking and reflecting and writing, podcasting, conversing. They're so insightful and so generous with their insights, and we're so the beneficiaries. So I feel like I'm always working with other people's ideas. Always. I don't always break that down, not least of all because what I share in these talky bits is often a blended version of what I'm reading, of podcasts I'm listening to, of conversations I'm having, of all of those sorts of things. And there's sort of this backlog, and the way this works in my head is it's sort of this backlog of stuff that gets in there and then seeps into my lived experience and then reflects back to me. And by the time I get to talking about some of these ideas, I often really don't have a clue whose ideas are whose anymore. And that, I think that's fine as far as it goes, but sometimes I know I'm drawing much more directly on somebody's work. And when I'm conscious of that, I don't want to neglect to mention it. And so this morning, I feel particularly indebted to the thought and writing of Pete Rollins. I know I've mentioned him here before. I'm happy to commend him to anybody that feels like they want a vigorous exploration of belief. Rollins can be profoundly unsettling, so I would say don't read him if you aren't open to a bit of a shakeup. But if you are open to that, I don't personally know of anyone better at the moment. And like any good writer, Rollins and thinker, his work is grounded in the work of others. He's trained as a philosopher, and he's very conscious of his philosophical influences especially. And he's also great at giving credit where it's due, and so if you do take the time to read him, he's one of those people where, for whom every page opens a wider world, you know? It's really lovely, lovely thing. Last week we started to set up what I said would be an exploration of some of the sort of tenets of Christianity that are not only deeply held, but that are often so deeply held that to even bring them up for discussion or exploration could feel like undermining the thing of Christianity itself. As part of that conversation, I asked if it was possible to have faith without the Bible, which when you say it in that short of sentence feels like an obvious question, a rhetorical question. I suggested that faith in its simplest form is just belief. It's not more, it's not less, it's just belief. And then I asked the question, what might give that simplest form some substance or some actionable shape? If faith is just belief, what might give faith shape, actionable shape? And I think there are lots of reasons why that's an important question. One of the reasons why I think that's an important question is that we seem to need to give our faith substance or actionable shape. It's a human drive to do this with what we believe. And we explored that a little bit last week, in part through the window of the biblical text in Hebrews that lays out the challenge of hoping in what we can't see. Another reason that I think that actionable shapes that we give our faith is important is because they can easily become, those actionable shapes can easily become the very thing that we start to have faith in. One of the reasons that the actionable shapes for faith is important is because those shapes can easily become the thing that we start to have faith in. And this would be that Frankensteinian part that I mentioned in the blurb, for which I immediately got a response from someone saying, I'd said in the blurb that there was sort of this Frankenstein idea that I was going to talk about and that I wouldn't talk about it much, so if you weren't a fan of the genre, you didn't have to worry. I immediately get this email back from someone in the community going, Shelley's Frankenstein? Oh, that's my favorite book. Talk about it as much as you want. They're not here. Because I emailed them back and said, I'm not going to talk about it very much. So I think they just decided I'll forget it. Let me put it another way. Even though faith without action is, as the ancient wisdom of the Bible says, dead, the shapes that we give to our faith or to our belief often take the place of faith itself. Whatever it is that we place our faith in can become, when we make it into a system of belief, something that takes over from faith. This could be, if you're an historian of even the most amateur sense, take this with a grain of salt, this could be understood as the very short and non-nuanced version of the history of religions. Sort of like this. Human being looks up at the sky or observes the birth of a child or some other experience that causes them to muse about mystery or awe, and human thinks, what's behind all that? Whatever is behind all that, I want to believe, I want to have faith in that. And at this point, more or less, said human starts to try to imagine what that is. And one of the ways that we do that as humans, one of the ways we do that imagining, it's built into the word itself, imagine, is by making images. Image in ink. We just do that. And we might make those images of what we're trying to imagine with stuff. We might make them with words. We might make them with systems of belief, which we then tend to represent with words and stuff. But we do tend to make them. And those systems of belief are often very helpful to us as humans, especially when it comes to addressing ourselves to the question, what might it look like to turn my belief into action? The images we make when we are trying to imagine what is behind the thing that we wish to have faith in, those images often inform the way we act out what we call our faith or our belief. The problem is that it seems to be such a short step from how does my system of belief help me turn my faith into action to my system of belief is what I place my faith in. It doesn't seem like a very long journey sometimes from one of those to the other. And I don't know if I did a good enough job of that to make visible what happened there. But what I was trying to describe is how something we seem to need to make in order to act out our faith becomes the very thing that undermines faith itself. And that's a conundrum. When we talked last week, and in other ways in the weeks before that, about why we sometimes feel afraid to explore what we believe, part of the answer to that question lies in this exact dilemma. See, even if we suspect or see evidence that something we have trusted in might be failing, or may even have failed, but we don't confront that failure, we can go on operating as though whatever it is we trust, or say we trust, is still holding up. So let me say that again. We live in a world of short sentences. That was a long one. Even if we suspect or see evidence that something we've trusted in might be failing or might have failed, but we don't confront that failure, we can go on operating as though whatever we trust is still holding up. We can see how this is true in our relational lives, right? I mean, it could be in a friendship, it could be in an intimate relationship, it could be in a marriage. As long as we don't ask certain questions, we can avoid acknowledging the ways the relationship is failing or has failed. And it might even be obvious to the people around us that their relationship is hollow or that it's failing, but as long as we don't bring up the obvious reality, the relationship can continue to function. And often, sort of in a bare minimum kind of way, but it can kind of keep chugging along, right? It's not that the relationship isn't in crisis. It is. It's that the crisis isn't being acknowledged, and so the effects are not being directly dealt with or felt. Things being as they are for us as humans, it's still likely that the effects are going to show up indirectly. That might look like in a close relationship between two people, that might look like lots of things, but common ones would be things like outbursts of anger that seem out of proportion to the causal event. This is where we get the at a distance humorous stereotype of squeezing toothpaste in the wrong spot or leaving the toilet seat in the wrong position. Where did all that rage come from about this insignificant, you know, whatever, right? Pick one. So that's a sign, right? That points somewhere. Or other ways that this being on the horns of this conundrum show up in relationships are things like we just go to what numbs us out. And sometimes those things are obviously self-destructive. It's easy to pick on addiction or substance abuse or blah, blah, blah. But, man, the common ones are potent, right? Let's talk about work. Let's talk about Netflix. Let's talk about whatever we go to so we don't have to ask the question about the way our system is breaking down and we don't want to talk about it or look at it directly. But they show up. These things show up, right? Depression. There's lots of possibilities. We could go on. And one of the reasons that this is the way that it is because it's really pretty difficult for most of us to acknowledge when some system that we're committed to isn't working. That is a scary place to be. Because even if we don't acknowledge it, we can sense that just admitting that something systemic isn't working can take us down the path of blowing it up or watching it crumble or having to do the enormous work of overhauling our lives. Most of the time, don't want to look down the barrel of that. That's hard. And I know I'm doing lots of broad brush things this morning. I'm going to do another one. In typical human fashion, that would be the broad brush. It seems that the fearsome part of this is way easier to see than the potentially life-giving part of this. Some of that is just the way we're wired neurologically. Some of that neurological wiring I would prefer to understand in terms of evolution. There's a reason why we don't tend to blow up systems in our lives, because it makes us vulnerable. And we're pretty much coded to not make ourselves vulnerable. That's why we're still here. Okay, so this matters. But in terms of these kinds of experiences, one of the things that we now know about neuroscience is that when we have a negative or hurtful or harmful experience, it is immediately imprinted on our memory. Right now. If we have a positive experience and we want to imprint it on our memory, we have to stop and spend conscious time with it, or it doesn't do that. It doesn't stick. Isn't that interesting? I just find this stuff so fascinating. There's a part of me that thinks that much of the explanations of what it means to be human that I feel like I grew up with were just like nobody was reading pop neuroscience, or they would have kind of gone there and gone, this is so fascinating. This is so much more fascinating than Eve ate the apple, and so everything's broken. I don't know. Anyway, that's a huge egregious leap. Follow it if you want. Don't follow it if you don't. I don't care. We seem to be wired like that. So, well, that's not what we're exploring this morning. I'm going to move on. That's intriguing. Off to the side. When we take on something in our lives that is deeply entrenched, one of the things that we have to do is sort of climb over our own history and our own patterns and even our own commitments to just kind of like get a glimpse of the thing itself that's threatening. Because all of this other stuff is already in place. And even if it's functioning minimally, it's functioning. And there's something in our gut that says, if you crawl on top of that and you look over the edge at the thing that you sense is there that's threatening, you know, the way this is all functioning right now, it's going to stop functioning. It's going to go boom. And when it goes boom, you're not going to know what to say about what you believe at Christmas when you're with your family. You're not going to know how to think about your recycle bin. You're not going to know how to go shopping. You're not going to know how to operate socially because your tribe is going to fracture. Like, it just goes on and on, right? So all this stuff is back there. It's not that we can't know it. It's not that hard to know. It's that we don't wish to face into it because it's frightening. And the fact that we are afraid of it, if I haven't said it obviously enough, I want to say it again. The fact that we are afraid of it is not a judgment of character. It's not a weakness in us, categorically. We are bent this way for all sorts of observable reasons. This is not easy stuff to do for all sorts of innately human reasons. There's this well-known contemporary parable of a rich businessman. He's strolling back to the office after lunch when he goes past a person that's fishing. I presume this parable was crafted by someone in Vancouver, maybe around Granville. In any case, this fisher person, who must be a woman, you'll see what I mean in a moment, they're just picking up this bucket of fish that they've caught and getting ready to head out. And the businessman sees this happening and he says to them, where are you going? And the fisher person says, I'm just going to go up to the fresh fish market up here. I'm going to sell my fish. And the businessman says, well, how long did it take you to catch those? And the fisher person says, well, a couple hours. And he says, well, what are you going to do for the rest of the day? And the fisher person says, well, I thought maybe I'd go hang out at the beach with my family. I'd tilt a cold one. I'd chat with whoever was there. And the business guy says, but if you keep fishing, you could catch more fish and you can make more money. And the fisher person says, well, why would I do that? And the business guy says, well, if you had more money, you could buy better equipment and you could catch more fish. And within a few years, you might have enough for like a boat and a net, maybe a few boats and a few nets. And if you keep at it, you might even be able to scale up, not an intentional pun, to a fleet of boats. And maybe you could figure out how to sell fresh fish online. And the fisher person says, and then what? The business guy says, well, and then you could like you could go to the beach and have a cold one and chat with your friends. Right? This is how this works. In the book of Proverbs, the idiots are all men and the sages are all women. There you go. So that's why I said that. Regardless of those kind of details, the issue that's easy to see in the parable, but sometimes so hard to see in our life, is that sometimes the path that we choose to our own ideals is the problem. And in the case of the parable, the businessman's work has failed to give him the very thing that he wants. Because when he articulates the ideal, it's the thing that the fisher person with their couple hours worth of fish is off to enjoy. And because it's a parable, we can see that he could have the thing he wants, but not unless he acknowledges the failure of his current position. That's what's in the way. And that is hard to do for all these reasons we've been talking about, for so many reasons. One of the core reasons that this kind of work is difficult is because it calls for a way of seeing the world around us that does not depend on a system of belief. I don't know about you, but this is a little hard for me to imagine. I had to work for this because I am so deeply trained in this idea of worldview. Not a bad idea. It just only reaches so far. That's the problem. I am so steeped in the thinking that the systemic grid through which you view the world is the key, that the idea that there might be a way of seeing that isn't system first is an oddity. And I have to kind of come at it around the end. So that's what I'm going to do. If you don't need that, just take a little vacation and come back. If I was going to try to say that another way, there is a way of looking at what's all around us that isn't a new belief about the world so much as it's a way of relating to the world. It's not a way of seeing what others can't see. It's a way of seeing what's already visible. It's a way of perceiving or receiving what is already given. If we wanted to put this into God language, because that set of ideas can apply to many different things, not just spiritual things. But if we wanted to put this into God language, we might say that this is a way of seeing that is captured in the idea of God as love. That is different. Utterly different than seeing God as loving. That's the switch in theological language. Between the difference between God is love and God is loving. Last week I talked about the idea of God not being located in any place, but rather as inhabiting nothing, which is how we tend to perceive the spaces between things. But that's what most of the universe is comprised of. This is analogous to that. God as love is a way of expressing the idea that what is sacred is not found in some distant object toward which we focus our love, but rather is something that is testified to or something that becomes real in the act of loving. It's not real without that, would be another way to say it. It becomes real in the act of loving. I told you this was a bit of a hmm. When we look at it that way, we can see that faith is not a set of beliefs about the world, but rather it's an experience that is found in the loving embrace of the world. If I was going to try to illustrate this from the vantage point of Christianity, I might suggest that it's often the case that that religion, Christianity, has reduced crucifixion and resurrection, for instance, to systemic religious affirmations that are held by a certain tribe rather than expressions of a type of life. They become events about which we quarrel rather than a way in which we live, for instance, would be another way to say it. And when that happens, and this isn't exclusive to Christianity, even though that's how I just illustrated it, when that happens, the event that they testify to is almost completely overshadowed or hidden or eclipsed by the religious or systemic system of belief. All of a sudden, the thing that's meant to be an event, a way of being in the world, of getting it into our arms and our arms into it, becomes an idea. Completely different. And when we get into that kind of terrain, any system of belief is vulnerable to being fundamentally misunderstood and misapplied to how we live. And from there, it's a short step to having religious or systemic beliefs serve as a justification for drawing lines about who's in and about who's out, and which is a kind of violence. And on the heels of that, violence of all sorts. More on that another time. I said in the blurb that I was going to suggest a couple of ways we might discern when this is happening to our own currently held positions in ways that might be keeping us from the very things that we're looking for, that might make us the businessman in the fishing parable. And I think one of the most telling models that I've come across for doing that kind of discerning work is the idea of the difference between an idol and an icon. I'm going to present this by way of contrast and compare. Something that I remain reluctant about because it makes it too easy. It makes binary something that is way more complex than that. However, I'm going to offer this in the hope that it might serve as a starting point for the further exploration of something complex rather than a stopping point, rather than a this or that. That's what I'm hoping. So by way of opening this idea then, a couple of thoughts about the difference between the idea of idol and the idea of icon. Idol is a theological term, and it's a term for an imaginary thing. So far, so good, right? Idol is a theological term for an imaginary thing that we imagine might make us whole. Okay, anybody ever been let down by their system of belief when it was called Christianity? Like, ever? Don't put up your hand. Like, honestly, idol is the term for an imaginary thing that we believe will make us whole. Okay, icon is a way of holding something that draws us into an experience of wonder and awe. Does one of these strike you as enlarging and the other as reducing? That's how they strike me. An idol stands eternally outside of our world. The symbol for it might be here, but it stands outside of our world. It's not from here. An icon is in our world. An idol is always at a distance. An icon is present. One intriguing feature of this way of thinking about the icon is that although it's present, it doesn't abolish distance as much as it relocates it. I've wrestled for myself personally and both in my own life and relationships and conversation and in this kind of strange public role of talking about these things to people. I have wrestled to try to find language for this. And I tend to end up talking about relocating God because God language is where I tend to go when I'm talking about mystery. If God is never present, if God is not intrinsically here, if God stands eternally outside of our world and our system of belief, under these ideas that we're talking about this morning, guess what we just did with God? We just turned God into idol. When someone, a person, like icon is not an exclusively religious idea. I know we tend to use that word around iconography and so on, around spiritual symbols. But it's not a religious word, theological word at its core. When another person even is an icon for us, their very presence is experienced by us as a kind of mystery. And there is something in an icon that still resists being fully known, but it's not because we are separated from them. It's rather because the mystery lies within the icon itself. So instead of the icon being some other time, some other place, it's here, it's now. We can experience it in as full a way as we are capable of experiencing something and not exhaust it. It's like the icon is with us, and yet there is something about it that is still to arrive. You see how this way of approaching things that are spiritual refuses to fall to either or. You have to have a third way. You have to be able to hold things in tension and have a third way of thinking to do this. And that takes some practice. At least it does for me. The things that draw us to the icon, which we might use a word like love to describe, keep drawing us to it at the same time that those things that draw us are unfulfilled. And so the experience with the icon is it's more like the things that draw us to icon don't satisfy our desire, but what they do instead is they intensify it. They make it bolder. They make it deeper. But they don't fulfill it. Which brings us back to that first idea about idol. One of the ways we can tell if we're dealing with idol or icon thinking is by looking at the thing that we're thinking about and asking of ourselves, do I expect this to fulfill me? That's an interesting test, right? Think about how much religious language you've heard. Think about how much religious investment you've experienced in the idea that this will fulfill you. That's interesting, eh? What if at the core of healthy spirituality is not something, a sacred object, that fulfills us, but a desire that when we engage with it, makes the desire greater? That's different. That's not the same thing. That's not the same idea at all. One last contrast. When we focus on an idol, we find ourselves focused on some special object that makes everything else in the world seem mundane. And with an icon, what we focus on helps us experience the mundane as infused with special significance. If I was going to use God language again, the shortest sentence I could think of is, this is the idea of God in the midst of all of life. Not some other time, not some other place, not reserved for special spaces, which does not make them not special. See, this is that kind of a twist. I had this conversation with a wise, very educated theologian one time, and his argument kept coming back to, well, about space as being sacred. If no particular spaces are sacred, then nowhere is sacred. And I realized when he said that, I was like, you know, I appreciate you deeply, and we can't keep going in this conversation because I'm actually not looking for an either-or way to think about the sacred. I'm looking for a both-and way to think about the sacred. I'm looking for a way to live in this world that doesn't mean I have to step out of it to be in the presence of God. I'm looking for a spirituality that is so infused that even when I come up hard up against, deeply, painfully up against the conundrums of life, the things that just make me go, what the, right? That God's there, and no less there than in the, isn't that awesome, of life, whatever that looks like. I'm looking for a spirituality that doesn't require religion. This is not to say that religion would have no place in such a spirituality, but it would not have the place of preeminence in it. It would be a servant, that spirituality, not its master. And it wouldn't actually be the doorway in to that sort of a spirituality. There would be no doorway in, except the realization that we're in it. And what religion would behave like in such a spirituality is a humbly held framework that I make, that we make, that serves me well, that is made for me, not me for it, to come back to Jesus' commentary on the Sabbath that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. Made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You want to make a system of belief? You feel compelled to make a system of belief? You need to make a system of belief? All these things might be true. Go ahead. You can't stop yourself if you try, if you're a human. Just don't call that thing God. And don't think that that thing is the thing that opens onto God. That thing is the thing that serves the thing that you trust. It is not the thing that you trust. Is this making it better or worse? I'm going to stop. I don't want to assume that your experience is like mine, but I feel like I've got plenty to chew on for now, so I'm going to just be done. And next week we're going to explore some ways that some of those kind of ideas open into a different sort of hope, because they do change the actionable shape of belief. All right, peace.